In May 1984, 23-year-old Shannon Rose Lloyd was found murdered in her Garden Grove apartment. No forced entry, no witnesses, and no suspect the police could hold. The case went cold year after year. Her mother, Patricia, refused to let Shannon's name be forgotten. She kept calling, kept writing, kept fighting for 37 years. Then, a single fingernail scraping from the crime scene, stored in an evidence box since the night Shannon died, was tested with new DNA technology. The result pointed to a man who had never been on the suspect list, a man living in plain sight. What followed was a race to prove the match, a tense arrest, and a courtroom reckoning that would end one of California's longest-running cold cases. This complete three-episode true crime series takes you from the night of the murder, through decades of frustration, to the moment justice finally caught up. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave a comment. The next story might change your mind. Don't miss a single turn. Chapter 1. The Night in Garden Grove. Garden Grove, California. May 20, 1984. I still remember the way the street looked that night, though I wasn't there in 1984. I've seen it so many times in photographs, old police video, and yellowed clippings that it feels like a memory. A narrow strip of asphalt, lined with modest apartment buildings. The kind of place where people keep their curtains drawn halfway. A streetlight burned out on the corner, leaving part of the block in shadow. The police photographer's flash lit it all up. The doorway, the stairwell, the window where a light never came on again. Shannon Rose Lloyd lived alone in a second-floor apartment on this street. She was 23. She worked at a local clothing store and was known for her warm laugh and the way she always remembered people's names. Her friends described her as steady, not the kind of person who jumped into drama. The few possessions she owned were neat and tidy. A coffee table stacked with magazines, a sofa she'd bought secondhand, and a framed picture of her with her parents in front of Disneyland. That Sunday night, Shannon came home from a quiet dinner with a friend. Nothing unusual. No frantic calls. No one followed her up the stairs. At least, that's what the surviving witnesses said. The police would later note there were no signs of forced entry, suggesting she either knew her killer or trusted them enough to open the door. The first call to police came at 6:48 a.m. on May 21, 1984. A neighbor, a woman in her late 50s, had knocked on Shannon's door to see if she wanted to share a cup of coffee before work. When there was no answer, the neighbor assumed she'd left early. It wasn't until another neighbor, a man delivering the newspaper, noticed Shannon's door ajar that concern began to spread. He peeked in and saw her lying motionless in the living room. By the time Garden Grove PD arrived, the scene was already compromised. Two neighbors had stepped inside, calling Shannon's name, leaving footprints and partial handprints on the carpet and furniture. One of them touched her shoulder, hoping she was unconscious. She wasn't. The medical examiner would later estimate her time of death between 10 p.m. and midnight. The crime scene photos show the apartment in eerie stillness. The coffee table had been pushed several inches off its usual spot. A lamp lay on its side, the bulb shattered. One of Shannon's earrings was found under the couch, as if it had been torn off. The signs of a struggle were subtle but undeniable. The cause of death, blunt force trauma, came from a single, decisive blow, followed by strangulation. Police believed it was over within minutes. Detective Robert Malley, one of the first on scene, later described the apartment as quiet but charged. He noticed an untouched plate of food in the kitchen sink. Pasta, now dried and cracking at the edges. There was a glass of red wine next to it, still half full. Whoever had killed Shannon either hadn't stayed long after, or they'd been careful to touch very little. The investigation began immediately. Officers canvassed the neighborhood, asking if anyone had heard anything unusual. One resident recalled a muffled thud around 11 p.m., but thought nothing of it. Another remembered seeing a man's silhouette near Shannon's window around 9 p.m., but couldn't describe his face. These scraps of memory would be all police had to work with in the early days. At the time, Garden Grove wasn't a high-crime city, but the murder sent a ripple of fear through the community. Women began locking their doors earlier. Parents warned their daughters not to walk alone after dark. Local news aired daily updates, replaying the same grainy exterior shot of Shannon's building over and over. The pressure on police was immediate and unrelenting. Evidence was collected carefully, for 1984 standards. Hair fibers, fingerprints, and a small swab from under Shannon's fingernails were logged and sealed. Without DNA technology, those samples sat in storage, their value limited to what could be matched visually or chemically. At the time, police pinned their hopes on fingerprints. But weeks later, when the analysis came back, none matched anyone in the state's database. What struck me most, going through the original case filed decades later, was the margin of error in every step. Witness statements contradicted each other. The neighbor who swore she saw a man near Shannon's window later admitted she'd been drinking that night. The man who found the door open changed his story about what time it was. And yet, the core fact, Shannon was killed in her home by someone she likely knew, never changed. The autopsy report paints the final clinical picture. A single head injury consistent with being struck by a blunt object, followed by manual strangulation. No defensive wounds beyond light bruising on her forearms, suggesting she was caught off guard. Toxicology showed no drugs or alcohol beyond the half glass of wine in her system. For the police, the case began here, with a young woman's life ended in a quiet apartment and a handful of clues that refused to speak. For me, this was the start of a question that would last 37 years. Who walked into Shannon's apartment that night, and why did they think they could get away with murder? Chapter 2, A City on Edge. When a murder happens in a small or mid-sized city, the first wave of impact is shock. The second is paranoia. By the summer of 1984, Garden Grove had both. The day after Shannon Rose Lloyd's death, the Orange County Register ran the headline. Young woman found dead in apartment, police suspect foul play. Below it was a black and white photo of Shannon taken from her driver's license. It was the kind of image that strips away personality, flat lighting, unsmiling, utilitarian. But for her family and friends, that photograph was an injustice in itself. Shannon had been vibrant, warm, and full of life, and now the public would only know her as the face in that tiny rectangle on the front page. The Garden Grove Police Department held a press conference that morning in the cramped basement of City Hall. The lead detective, Robert Malley, spoke for 3 minutes. He confirmed Shannon's name, her age, her address, and that her death was being treated as a homicide. When pressed by reporters for details about how she was killed, Malley shut it down. "We're not going to release specifics at this time." That refusal to give details only fueled speculation. Talk radio hosts guessed out loud whether this was the work of a stranger, a jealous boyfriend, or a serial predator. Local bartenders, barbers, and grocery store clerks swapped rumors that morphed with each telling. One version claimed Shannon had been stalked for weeks. Another claimed she'd been seen arguing with a man outside her apartment 2 nights before. None of it was confirmed, but all of it was repeated. I interviewed residents who were children back then. They remember their parents locking windows they'd always left open. People began to check their back seats before getting into cars. The phrase "don't walk alone after dark" became more than parental advice. It became a rule of survival. The city's population in 1984 was about 140,000. Most people worked blue-collar or service jobs. Crime rates were moderate, burglaries, car thefts, the occasional assault. A brutal murder in a young woman's home was different. It wasn't something people could write off as gang violence or a bad drug deal. This felt targeted, intimate, and that made it worse. By week two, the police presence was impossible to miss. Uniformed officers walked apartment complexes, stopping to chat with residents, asking if they'd seen anything unusual. Detectives went door to door with clipboards, taking statements that would later fill dozens of binders in the case file. Patrol cars circled slowly through neighborhoods, lights off but visible enough to remind everyone they were there. Not all of the community's attention was supportive. There was frustration, even anger, at the lack of progress. Flyers with Shannon's picture, this time a smiling snapshot her family provided, appeared on telephone poles and in shop windows. But with each passing day, fewer people stopped to read them. I found a surviving copy of a Los Angeles Times article from June 4, 1984. The headline read, 2 weeks later, no leads in Garden Grove slaying. The piece quoted a woman who lived in Shannon's building. We thought they'd have someone in custody by now. You can't tell me they don't have anything. Behind the scenes, detectives were chasing down every name that came up in interviews. Shannon's co-workers were questioned. Her landlord was questioned. Ex-boyfriends were located and interviewed, some more than once. All of them denied involvement, and none could be tied to the crime seen through the limited forensics available. Shannon's funeral was held on May 26th at a small Catholic church in Santa Ana. Nearly 200 people attended. The service was quiet, heavy with disbelief. Detectives attended in plain clothes, scanning the crowd. They watched for unusual behavior. Someone who wouldn't meet their eyes, someone crying too hard, someone not crying at all. They saw nothing that led anywhere. In neighborhoods far from Shannon's, the murder became a cautionary tale. A college student told me her mother started sleeping with a baseball bat by the bed. A grocery store cashier said she carried pepper spray for the first time. Even people who had never met Shannon felt exposed, vulnerable. The longer the investigation went without an arrest, the bolder the rumors became. There was talk of a suspect list pinned to a board in the police department, with a dozen names. Whether that was true or not, it kept the gossip alive. And while some neighbors avoided talking to police for fear of getting dragged into something, others called in constantly with tips, most of which went nowhere. One thing was certain. The city would never be the same after that May night. Garden Grove, for all its palm-lined streets and family-run businesses, now carried the weight of a murder that didn't fit into any neat box. The killer was still out there, and no one knew if, or when, he might strike again. By midsummer, the case had already begun to slip from front pages. Other stories took its place: a local election, a freeway expansion, a heat wave. But for Shannon's family, and for the detectives still working the case, the pressure only grew heavier. And as I would learn later, this pressure would play a dangerous role in what came next. An investigation that moved fast, maybe too fast, and began steering toward the wrong suspects. Chapter 3. The First Investigation. The first weeks after Shannon's murder were a blur for the Garden Grove Police Department. A mix of urgency, public scrutiny, and blind corners. From my review of the original case files, it was clear they were determined to catch the killer quickly. But determination doesn't guarantee accuracy. The official investigative timeline began on May 21, 1984, the morning her body was found. By noon that day, the lead detectives had compiled a preliminary suspect list. It wasn't long, just six names, but it included anyone who had been in Shannon's orbit within the past 6 months. They started with the ex-boyfriend. His name appeared in several of Shannon's friends' statements. They'd dated for a year, broken up 3 months earlier. According to her friends, there had been no major fights, no restraining orders, no late-night calls. But the detectives couldn't ignore him. When they brought him in for questioning, he came willingly. His alibi, dinner with his sister across town, was verified within 24 hours. The problem was that alibi ended around 10:30 p.m., and the medical examiner's time of death range stretched as late as midnight. They pressed him on whether he'd been near Shannon's apartment that night. He denied it. They asked if she'd ever seemed afraid of anyone. He said no. The interview notes reveal a telling line from Detective Malley. Doesn't seem nervous enough. In 1984, gut instinct often carried as much weight as hard evidence. Still, without fingerprints or a witness placing him at the scene, he was released. The next name was the upstairs neighbor, a man in his 40s who had been living in the building for about 2 years. He was the one who claimed to have seen a man's silhouette outside Shannon's window on the night of the murder. Detectives quickly realized his account had inconsistencies. At first, he said the figure was tall and wearing a hat. Later, he said it might have been medium height and bareheaded. When asked to describe where exactly he was when he saw this, he said he'd been on the balcony. The balcony, as the crime scene photos confirm, faced the opposite side of the building from Shannon's unit. The only way he could have seen her window was by leaning dangerously far over the railing. Detectives began to wonder if he was inventing the sighting to insert himself into the case. They checked his alibi. He'd been at home watching television alone. No corroboration. Then came the coworker. Shannon had worked with her at the clothing store. This woman claimed Shannon had recently complained about a customer who lingered too long and asked personal questions. The coworker described him as creepy and too interested in her life. Detectives took this seriously, interviewing the store manager and pulling sales records to try to identify him. Nothing panned out. The customer was never found, and the lead fizzled. By the third week, detectives were widening the net. They looked at a maintenance worker for the building, noting his master key could have opened Shannon's apartment without force. he denied any involvement and passed a polygraph test. In 1984, that carried weight. Today, we know polygraphs are unreliable, but back then, a pass could shift focus away from a suspect entirely. Perhaps the most frustrating dead end came from an anonymous tip line call on June 3rd. A man claimed to have overheard two people at a bar talking about the girl in Garden Grove. He said one of them mentioned she didn't see it coming and laughed. The caller refused to give his name. Detectives checked bars in the area, but came up with nothing. The tip was logged, then left to gather dust. Reading through the interviews, what stands out is how many people wanted to help, and how many seemed to enjoy the attention of being connected to a murder case, even loosely. False memories, embellishments, and outright fabrications tangled the investigation. Forensic evidence wasn't giving detectives much to work with either. The fingerprints collected from Shannon's apartment belonged mostly to her and known visitors. A few unidentified prints were found on the kitchen counter, but without a match in the state database, they were useless. The hair fibers collected from the crime scene were analyzed for color and texture, but without DNA, they could only narrow them down to dark brown, possibly male. Still, Detective Malley and his partner pushed forward. They conducted 57 interviews in the first month. They worked long days, often into the night, chasing down every possible lead. But by late June, the reality was setting in. They didn't have enough to arrest anyone. In my conversations with surviving members of the original investigative team, the frustration is still there. One retired officer told me, "We were working blind. We didn't have the tools, and every day that passed made it harder." Another said, "I still think about the ones we ruled out too fast. It's easy, in hindsight, to point to mistakes. But in the summer of 1984, they were doing what they could with what they had. And what they had wasn't much. Each lead faded. Each suspect was eliminated or left hanging without enough evidence. By July, the file on Shannon Rose Lloyd's murder was getting thick, but the space for primary suspect remained blank. That blank space would stay that way for decades. But before it did, the detectives would take one more shot, a last push before the case began to cool. A push that would prove both desperate and dangerous. Chapter 4, The Case Grows Cold. The turning point came quietly. There was no dramatic announcement, no press conference declaring failure. One day the detectives were working Shannon's case full-time, and the next, it was just another file in the stack. It was late summer 1984 when the momentum truly slowed. The early flood of tips had thinned to a trickle. The news coverage that had once run daily was now buried on page 5, if it appeared at all. Other crimes, newer, louder, more solvable, were taking priority. In the Garden Grove Police Department, the walls of the homicide unit told their own story. Each case had a whiteboard with names, times, and leads scrawled across it. Shannon's board had been crowded in May and June. By August, half the writing was erased. The rest had gone stale. The persons of interest list was now a list of people we talked to. The once promising theories had been crossed out with thick black marker. The decision to scale back wasn't malicious. It was practical. Detective Robert Malley was assigned a new homicide in September. A double shooting in a motel parking lot. His partner was pulled to work on a series of armed robberies. The unofficial message was clear. Unless something big breaks, this case is on hold. For Shannon's family, the change was devastating. Her mother, Patricia, kept a spiral notebook of every phone call with police. In the early days, there were daily updates. By the fall, the entries were weeks apart. On October 2nd, she wrote, "Detective says nothing new. Asked again about the wine glass. He says they're still waiting on the lab. The lab results, when they came, were useless. No fingerprints clear enough to match anyone outside the people already known to have been in the apartment. Evidence handling in 1984 was a different world. The murder weapon, if it existed, was never found. The hair fibers, fingernail scrapings, and clothing were stored in paper envelopes, sealed with tape, and labeled by hand. The storage facility was climate controlled, but not by today's standards. There were no tamper-proof barcodes, no digital chain of custody logs. Items were checked in and out with pen and paper." Years later, a forensic expert would tell me, "It's a miracle the samples survived in usable condition." At the time, though, no one was thinking about decades. They were thinking about the next week, maybe the next month. In 1985, there was a brief flicker of renewed interest. a man in San Diego was arrested for a string of assaults that bore some similarities to Shannon's case. He targeted women in their homes, often entering without forced entry, and attacked late at night. Detectives compared notes, even drove down to interview him in person. He denied ever being in Garden Grove. Without DNA, they couldn't tie him to the crime scene. He was eventually convicted for the assaults in San Diego, but any link to Shannon was speculative at best. By 1986, the investigation was effectively dormant. It wasn't officially closed, homicides never are, but it had joined the growing list of cold cases that sat in storage, waiting for a break that might never come. The file was thick enough to fill a banker's box. On the side, written in black marker, were the words, Lloyd Shannon R. Homicide, May 21, 1984. That box would follow the department through three building moves over the next three decades. It would sit on shelves in evidence rooms and file archives, gathering dust but never disappearing entirely. For the family, the years that followed were measured not by milestones, but by absences. Birthdays, holidays, weddings. Each one was a reminder that Shannon wasn't there. Patricia called the police at least once a year, usually on the anniversary of her daughter's death. She was polite but persistent. Each year, the answer was the same, nothing new. The case's cold status also meant the rumors took on a life of their own. People whispered that the killer had moved away. Others said he was still in town, hiding in plain sight. Some believed the police knew who it was but couldn't prove it. Without answers, speculation became its own form of folklore. In 1990, a small article ran in the Orange County Register. 6 years later, no arrest in Garden Grove murder. It was a single column, with a grainy reprint of Shannon's smiling photo. The piece quoted Patricia, who said simply, "We're not giving up. We can't." By the time the 1990s ended, the world had changed. DNA was becoming a tool for solving crimes, but only in the most clear-cut cases, usually when biological evidence was fresh and abundant. Shannon's case didn't seem like a good candidate. The samples were old, minimal, and possibly contaminated. Testing them in those early days would have consumed all the material, with no guarantee of results. And so the box stayed sealed. When I first saw it, decades later, the tape was brittle, the handwriting fading. But it was all there. The photographs, the reports, the diagrams of the apartment, the tiny envelopes holding the evidence. At the time, I didn't know that those same envelopes would one day hold the key to solving the case. In 1984, they didn't have the science. In 1994, they didn't have the funding. And in 2004, they didn't have the will. But in 2021, all three would finally align. Until then, Shannon's murder was a wound the city learned to live with, quietly, painfully, and without closure. Chapter 5, New Tools, Old Wounds. The mid-1990s brought a quiet revolution to law enforcement. For the first time, detectives had a tool that could do what no witness, polygraph, or hunch ever could, DNA testing. It began making headlines in high-profile cases. In 1994, DNA helped convict O.J. Simpson in the court of public opinion long before a jury reached its controversial verdict. Around the same time, a man named Kirk Bloodsworth became the first American death row inmate to be exonerated by DNA evidence. These stories made the technology sound like magic, a perfect, unbreakable link between suspect and crime scene. Inside police departments, though, the reality was less glamorous. The tests were expensive, slow, and prone to failure if the evidence was degraded. And in a cold case like Shannon Rose Lloyd's, degradation was almost a given. I met retired forensic analyst Linda Carver in her small Orange County home. In the late 90s, she'd worked in one of the few California labs capable of processing DNA for criminal cases. She remembered when Shannon's file crossed her desk, not for testing, but for review. It was 1998, she told me, flipping through her personal scrapbook of solved and unsolved cases. I saw the note that there were fingernail scrapings and some fibers. The problem was, back then, we needed a lot more material than we do now. If we tested it and failed, that was it. There'd be nothing left for future testing. So the decision was made to hold off. The evidence stayed in storage, still sealed in its original envelopes. It wasn't unusual. Departments all over the country were sitting on old cases, waiting for technology to catch up to their evidence. Meanwhile, DNA was making headlines for its role in solving other decades-old murders. A 1976 case in San Diego. a 1981 murder in San Francisco. Each success sent a jolt of hope through the families of other victims, including Shannon's. Her mother, Patricia, called the department after each one. "Can't you do the same for Shannon?" she'd ask. Each time, the answer was cautious. "Maybe someday. Not yet." The 1990s were also the era of California's DNA database expansion. The state began collecting DNA from convicted felons and later from those merely arrested for certain crimes. The database grew, slowly at first, then exponentially. Detectives knew that even if they didn't have a suspect in mind, one could emerge if their DNA ended up in the system. But there was a darker side to the progress. Cold cases were being prioritized based on likelihood of success and public interest. Cases with famous victims or multiple unsolved killings got funding first. Shannon's case, tragic but quiet, with no other known linked crimes, often fell to the bottom of the list. In 2002, there was another close call. A detective new to the cold case unit pulled Shannon's file and submitted a request for partial DNA testing on the fingernail scrapings. The request made it through two layers of approval before being denied for budget reasons. The money went instead to a case with two child victims, which had a higher chance of yielding usable DNA. Patricia never knew about the denied request. She kept calling, every year, marking the anniversary with a fresh plea to look at it again. Her persistence became part of the case's unofficial timeline. Detectives knew the call was coming each May. Some took it as a reminder of their unfinished business. Others saw it as a burden they couldn't lift. By the late 2000s, the forensic landscape was shifting again. Newer testing methods, like STR, short tandem repeat, analysis, required less material and could produce results from older samples. Still, the backlog was immense. California's crime labs were drowning in requests. Shannon's case sat in line, year after year. When I asked retired Detective Malley about that period, he sighed. "It wasn't that we didn't care. We did. But I had cases stacking up on my desk every week. Unless something came in that put her case back in the spotlight, it stayed where it was." And yet, even in limbo, the case wasn't entirely forgotten. In 2011, an evidence review team audited the department's cold cases. Shannon's was flagged as having viable biological evidence, a note that would prove critical years later. The review also confirmed that the envelopes containing the fingernail scrapings and fibers were intact, still bearing their original 1984 seals. That same year, another shift began, the rise of familial DNA searching. It was controversial, raising privacy concerns, but it also opened a door for cases like Shannon's. Even if the killer wasn't in the database, a relative might be. By 2015, technology had reached a point where the old samples could finally be tested without destroying them. But the process required a dedicated cold case unit to prioritize the work. Garden Grove didn't have one. What it did have, by then, was a new generation of detectives, people who had grown up with DNA as part of policing, who understood its potential. One of them, a detective named Karen Holt, first read Shannon's file in 2016. She told me she was struck by how solvable it seemed. You had preserved evidence. You had a crime scene with no forced entry. You had a victim who almost certainly knew her killer. That's not nothing. Still, Holt's request to test the DNA went nowhere. The lab backlog was still years long, and the city had more recent homicides to process. It wasn't until 2020, nearly 36 years after Shannon's murder, that the cold case unit was formally reactivated, with Holt at the helm. By then, technology had advanced to the point where even degraded samples could yield results. The tools that had once seemed out of reach were now standard. And in the middle of a pandemic, with crime rates shifting and budgets being reshuffled, Holt found her opening. The fingernail scrapings were sent to the lab in early 2021. 3 months later, the results came back. For the first time in 37 years, the name of a living suspect was linked to Shannon's murder. But before the arrest, before the headlines, there was the moment that changed everything. A quiet click of a mouse in a dim lab, and the appearance of a match that no one had expected. By 2020, the murder of Shannon Rose Lloyd had lived in the cold case files for 36 years. Most people in Garden Grove barely remembered her name. The neighbors who had whispered about it in 1984 had moved away or passed on. The crime scene had been repainted, re-rented, and folded back into the rhythm of the city. But the box with her case number was still there, sealed, patient, and waiting. Detective Karen Holt didn't know Shannon personally. She was only a child when Shannon died. But when she took over the city's newly revived cold case unit, Shannon's file kept pulling her back. It wasn't just the crime itself, it was the evidence. So many cold cases from the 1980s had been destroyed, contaminated, or lost. Shannon's had survived. Inside the envelopes were fingernail scrapings, hair fibers, and clothing swatches, all still sealed from 1984. Back then, they were useless. Now they could speak, if the right person was willing to listen. The first time Holt held the envelope containing the fingernail scrapings, she knew what it meant. "This," she told me, "is probably the last conversation Shannon will ever have with the world. And it's my job to make sure someone's listening." In early 2021, the evidence went to the Orange County Crime Lab. The technicians handled it like it was made of glass. DNA testing in cold cases is a high-wire act. Too aggressive, and you destroy the sample. Too cautious, and you get nothing. Weeks passed, then months. On a gray Tuesday morning, the match appeared. It wasn't a suspect already in custody. It wasn't a man on the run. It was someone living an ordinary life, whose DNA had been collected in a separate, unrelated case years after Shannon's death. When Holt saw the name on the screen, she didn't shout. She didn't smile. She just sat back in her chair and stared at it. This was the moment every cold case detective dreams of, and fears. Because a DNA match is only the beginning. It doesn't explain motive. It doesn't tell you where the suspect was that night. And it doesn't prepare you for what happens when you knock on their door. For 37 years, the killer had been a shadow. Now he had a name. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave a comment. The next story might change your mind. Don't miss a single turn. Chapter 6: A Detective Returns. When Detective Karen Holt stepped into the Garden Grove Police Department's evidence room in early 2021, she wasn't looking for Shannon Rose Lloyd's file. She was there to get acquainted with the cold case backlog she had just inherited. More than 200 boxes, some dating back to the 1960s. The room smelled faintly of dust and cardboard. Metal shelves stretched from floor to ceiling, each row labeled in black stenciled numbers. Holt moved slowly, scanning the spines of the case boxes. Some were neatly stacked, others sagging under decades of weight. The older boxes were covered in scrawled handwriting from detectives who had long since retired or passed away. Shannon's case caught her eye for one reason. It was complete. So many older files had gaps, missing evidence logs, photographs that had faded beyond recognition, envelopes split open by time. But here, every item was intact. The crime scene photos were still sharp. The evidence envelopes were still sealed, their labels legible. Even the autopsy report was crisp, as if it had been printed yesterday. Holt carried the box to a small table in the corner and began flipping through the contents. The first layer was photographs. Shannon's apartment, the doorway, the coffee table pushed askew, the tipped over lamp. Holt lingered on the image of Shannon herself, taken from the crime scene before the coroner arrived. In her years of working homicide, Holt had learned to keep a mental distance when looking at victims, but this one stayed with her. The position of Shannon's body, almost peaceful, as if she had been caught mid-rest, clashed violently with the reality written in the autopsy report. Beneath the photos were the interview transcripts. They painted a picture Holt knew well. Too many witnesses with too few details, suspects with shaky alibis, and a set of detectives doing their best with limited tools. She could see the points where the investigation had run out of road. And then she found the envelopes. Two of them, each sealed with brittle masking tape and marked in a blocky 1980s hand. Fingernail scrapings, Lloyd S.R. Fibers, Lloyd S.R. Holt picked them up carefully. In 37 years, they had never been opened since the original forensic tech sealed them. In 1984, there had been no way to extract DNA from material this small without destroying it entirely. Now, with modern testing, even a few skin cells could tell a story. She set the envelopes aside and went back to the file. The notes from 2011 caught her attention. A cold case audit marking the evidence as viable for future testing. Yet somehow no one had followed through. I asked Holt later why she thought it had been overlooked. She shrugged. Sometimes these cases are like orphan children. Everyone means to help them, but they keep getting passed over because someone else always seems more urgent. That wasn't going to happen on her watch. Holt had joined the force in the late 90s, just as DNA was becoming a standard investigative tool. She'd seen firsthand how a cold case could be resurrected with a single match. She also knew the emotional toll of telling a family there was finally news after decades of silence. Her first step was to get approval to test the evidence. In most departments, this isn't as simple as sending it to the lab. The request goes up the chain of command, weighed against budget, backlog, and the perceived solvability of the case. In 2021, Garden Grove's backlog was heavy, but the pandemic had slowed new case flow enough to make room for old ones. Holt prepared a formal memo outlining the case history, the preserved evidence, and the potential for a DNA hit in state or national databases. She included copies of the original evidence logs and photographs of the sealed envelopes to prove their condition. She ended the memo with a single line. "This is the last opportunity we may have to identify Shannon Lloyd's killer." It worked. Approval came within 2 weeks. The evidence was couriered to the Orange County Crime Lab in a locked container, signed for at each handoff. Holt went with it, not because she had to, but because she wanted to be there when it arrived. "It felt like I was delivering something priceless," she told me. And in a way, I was. At the lab, a forensic analyst named Paul Rivera took custody of the evidence. Rivera had been working in forensics for nearly 2 decades. He understood the stakes of testing samples this old. "The trick," he said, "is to balance the risk. You can't go at it like you would a fresh sample. You have to coax the DNA out." Rivera explained the process to Holt step by step. "Carefully open the original envelope to avoid contamination. Transfer the material to a sterile workspace. Use a low copy number DNA extraction technique to maximize recovery. Amplify the sample through PCR, polymerase chain reaction, without degrading what's left." It could take weeks before they knew if they even had a viable profile. Holt returned to the station knowing she was now in a waiting game, one she couldn't control. In the meantime, she began digging into the original suspect list, cross-referencing it with modern databases. She pulled criminal records, employment histories, and address changes. Some of the original suspects were dead. Others were still living in California. None, as far as she could tell, had ever been charged with anything similar. When the call from Rivera finally came, it was early morning. Holt was in her office, working through another cold case file, when her phone rang. "We got a profile," Rivera said. His tone was calm, but Holt could hear the undercurrent of excitement. "And we got a hit. It wasn't a partial match. It was a full direct hit in the combined DNA index system, CODIS. The name attached to it was one Holt didn't recognize, someone who had never been on the original suspect list. When she typed the name into her computer, the first thing she found was an address, not far from Garden Grove. The ghost she'd been hunting for 37 years had just stepped into the light. Chapter 7, The DNA Breakthrough. The thing about a DNA match is that it's both a finish line and a starting gun. When the lab told Detective Karen Holt they had a name, it wasn't a solved case. It was an open door to an entirely new investigation. The name on the report was Stephen Richard Hensley, born in 1958, lived most of his life in Southern California, arrested in 2019 for a felony DUI, during which his DNA was collected and entered into CODIS. That entry, sitting quietly in the database for 2 years, was now the reason his life was about to change. Holt stared at the name on her screen for a long time before she clicked further. There was no mention of Shannon in his history. No violent convictions. In fact, his record was sparse. A few minor offenses in the 80s and 90s, mostly related to alcohol. He'd worked construction, then maintenance. Nothing in the file screamed killer. And yet, his DNA matched the profile pulled from the fingernail scrapings taken from Shannon's body in 1984. I asked Holt what that moment felt like. She leaned back in her chair, thinking, "It's electric but dangerous. You want to run into the street and yell, 'We got him.' But you can't. You have to slow down. You have to verify. DNA doesn't lie, but people can get the wrong idea if you don't build the rest of the case carefully." The first step was to confirm the match through an independent lab. Rivera, the forensic analyst, split the remaining sample and sent it to a private lab for verification. While they waited, Holt began the kind of deep dive that only modern tools allow. She pulled every address Hensley had ever lived at and mapped them out. In 1984, he'd been living less than 4 miles from Shannon's apartment. She found his employment records. At the time of Shannon's murder, he'd been working odd jobs and living alone. She checked marriage and divorce records, noting that he'd married in 1986 and divorced in 1992. There was no direct link to Shannon in any public record, but that didn't mean there wasn't one. Holt began looking at his social circles in the early 80s. Did he know anyone in Shannon's building? Had he ever been to the clothing store where she worked? Did he frequent the bars and restaurants near her home? Holt also pulled the original witness statements from 1984. One in particular stood out: the man who claimed to see a silhouette near Shannon's window. The description was vague, but the height estimate and build could fit Hensley. It was the kind of detail that wouldn't hold up in court alone, but in the context of a DNA match, it carried new weight. The independent lab came back with the same result. The DNA from the fingernail scrapings matched Stephen Richard Hensley with a probability so high it might as well have been certain. With the match confirmed, Holt began working with the Orange County District Attorney's Office to plan the next steps. They needed to approach Hensley without tipping him off. If he suspected he was being investigated for murder, he could flee, destroy evidence, or worse. They started with surveillance. Plainclothes officers parked near his current home, a modest one-story house in a quiet neighborhood. They watched his routines: morning coffee runs, weekly trips to the grocery store, evenings on the porch smoking cigarettes. He seemed unremarkable, the kind of neighbor you nod to but never really know. One officer told me he was friendly enough, waved at people, chatted with the mailman. You'd never look at him and think he was capable of killing someone. Holt's challenge was to connect the dots between this mild-mannered man in 2021 and the violent act committed in 1984. The DNA was the bridge, but she still needed motive, opportunity, and a narrative a jury could follow. She dug into his background further, speaking with people who had known him in the 80s. Some remembered him as quiet, others as a drinker. One woman recalled a party where he'd made inappropriate comments to several women, but nothing that would have led her to suspect murder. Still, it was a piece of character evidence that began to fill in the edges. The DA's office decided they had enough to move forward with an arrest warrant, but they wanted to do it in a way that minimized risk. Hensley wasn't known to own firearms, but no one wanted to take chances. The plan was to arrest him in a public place where he'd be less likely to resist. Holt coordinated with a local patrol unit. They'd wait until he left home for one of his coffee runs, then intercept him in the parking lot. She would be there in person, not because it was necessary, but because after 37 years, she wanted to look him in the eye when he heard Shannon's name. The morning of the arrest was overcast. Hensley came out of his house wearing jeans and a faded baseball cap. He got into his pickup truck and drove to a strip mall cafe. He parked, got out, and started walking toward the entrance. That's when two officers approached, identified themselves, and told him he was under arrest for the murder of Shannon Rose Lloyd. According to Holt, he froze. No denial, no anger. Just a long, blank stare. Then quietly, "Who?" It was either an act, or he'd buried Shannon's name so deep in his memory that hearing it now was like opening a locked door. Either way, the ghost they'd been chasing for nearly four decades was no longer a shadow. He was standing in the daylight, surrounded by police, with his past finally catching up to him. Chapter 8, The Arrest. The moment Stephen Richard Hensley was handcuffed in the parking lot, the 37-year shadow over Shannon Rose Lloyd's case shifted into something tangible. For decades, the idea of the killer had been abstract, a faceless presence in old files and fading memories. Now that presence had a height, a weight, a face, and a heartbeat. Detective Karen Holt was there, watching from a short distance. She'd insisted on being part of the arrest, not for the thrill, but for the accountability. This was her case now, and she wanted to see the man who had left Shannon lifeless on her living room floor. The officers moved quickly. One secured Hensley's wrists behind his back, another took his wallet and keys. He didn't fight. He didn't ask why they were arresting him until they guided him toward the patrol car. "Murder of Shannon Rose Lloyd," the officer repeated, loud enough for Holt to hear. Hensley's head turned slightly, just enough to catch Holt's gaze. She said nothing. In her experience, the first words exchanged between detective and suspect could set the tone for everything that followed. She wanted his first conversation to be inside the interrogation room, where every word could be recorded and every reaction preserved. Once Hensley was in the back seat, Holt followed the patrol car to the Garden Grove Police Department. The route was familiar. She'd driven it countless times with other suspects. But this time, every streetlight felt like a checkpoint in a race that had taken nearly 4 decades to run. Inside the station, Hensley was processed like any other arrestee. His fingerprints were taken, his mugshot captured in a series of clicks. He was allowed to use the restroom, then placed in interview room 3, a small, windowless space with cinderblock walls painted a neutral gray. The table was metal, the chairs heavy and plain. A video camera in the corner recorded silently. Before entering, Holt and her partner, Detective Luis Moreno, reviewed the strategy. Moreno would start with small talk, ease into the conversation, then let Holt take the lead when it came to the crime. The goal was to keep Hensley talking, not to push him into immediate silence with aggression. When they walked in, Hensley was sitting still, hands flat on the table. He looked older than his 63 years, his skin weathered, his eyes guarded but not hostile. He wore a plain t-shirt and jeans, the same clothes from his coffee run. Moreno started casually. "Stephen, thanks for talking with us. We know it's been a long time since 1984. Hensley raised his eyebrows but said nothing. "You were living in Garden Grove back then?" Moreno asked. "Yeah," Hensley replied, his voice low. "Couple miles from here." Holt leaned forward. "Do you remember Shannon Rose Lloyd?" There was a pause. Not long, but long enough to notice. "No," he said finally. "Should I?" Holt slid a photo of Shannon across the table. Not the crime scene photo. A smiling picture from her family. "She was killed in her apartment in May of 84. We have reason to believe you were there that night." Hensley glanced at the photo, then looked away. "I don't know her." Moreno kept his tone even. "Stephen, we have your DNA from her fingernail scrapings. That means she scratched you during the struggle. There's no mistake about this." Hensley's jaw tightened. "That's impossible. I never met her." Holt let the silence stretch. In interrogation, silence can be more powerful than any question. She watched his hands. They twitched once, then flattened again. "People forget things after 37 years, she said finally. "But DNA doesn't forget. It doesn't get old. It doesn't change. And it's telling us you were the last person to see her alive." For the next hour, Hensley alternated between denial and vague claims that maybe we crossed paths somewhere. He offered no explanation for how his DNA ended up under Shannon's nails. He didn't ask for a lawyer immediately, but he also didn't give a confession. Holt had expected this. In her experience, most suspects in decades-old cases didn't break in the first interview. The shock of the arrest, the unfamiliarity of being back in police custody, it made them cautious. The goal today wasn't a confession. It was to gauge his reactions, to note his tells, and to lock him into statements that could later be challenged with evidence. When Hensley finally asked for an attorney, the interview ended. Holt stood, collected the file from the table, and left the room without another word. In the hallway, Moreno exhaled. "He's not going to admit it." "Not today," Holt said. "But he doesn't need to. We have the science. Now we build the rest." Building the rest meant retracing Hensley's life from 1984 onward. Detectives searched his old residences, talked to former landlords, and tracked down people he'd known in the early 80s. Some recalled him as quiet, others as off. One woman described him as the kind of guy who stood too close when he talked to you. They also dug into his work history, looking for connections to Shannon's neighborhood. A faded time card from 1984 showed he'd been doing maintenance work for a company that serviced several apartment complexes, one of them less than 2 blocks from Shannon's building. Meanwhile, the DA's office began preparing the case for court. They knew the defense would attack the age of the evidence, the possibility of contamination, and the reliability of DNA from decades-old samples. Every step of the chain of custody from 1984 onward had to be airtight. For Holt, the arrest was both a victory and a warning. In cold cases, arresting the suspect is not the end. It's often the point where the real fight begins. And if Shannon's family was finally going to see justice, they couldn't afford a single misstep. Hensley was booked into the Orange County Jail on a charge of murder. Bail was denied. He was placed in a standard holding cell, surrounded by men half his age. In the eyes of the law, he was now an accused killer. In the eyes of Shannon's family, he was the man they had been waiting to face for 37 years. Chapter 9: Confronting the Past. The morning after Stephen Richard Hensley's arrest, the phones in the Garden Grove Police Department started ringing before the sun was up. By 9 a.m., every major news outlet in Southern California had the story. Arrest made in 1984 murder of Shannon Rose Lloyd, DNA breakthrough after 37 years. For most people reading those headlines, Shannon's name was just another in a long list of crime victims. But for her family, it was a moment they'd been imagining and dreading for nearly four decades. Detective Karen Holt insisted on telling them in person. She called Shannon's younger brother, Mark, now in his late 50s, and asked if the family could meet her at their mother's house. Patricia Lloyd was 81 years old, still living in the same modest home she had when Shannon died. She moved slower now, her hair completely white, but her mind was sharp. When Holt arrived, Patricia was sitting at the kitchen table with a mug of tea in front of her. The table was the same one from 1984, worn smooth in the middle from decades of use. Mark sat beside her, his hands clasped tightly. Holt began gently. "Patricia, Mark, we've made an arrest in Shannon's case. His name is Stephen Richard Hensley. We have his DNA from Shannon's fingernail scrapings. He was living in the area in 1984. Patricia closed her eyes for a long moment. "I prayed for this," she said finally. "I prayed I'd be alive to hear it." Mark's reaction was quieter. "Do you know why he did it?" "Not yet," Holt replied. "But we're going to find out." Patricia reached across the table and took Holt's hand. "Promise me you won't let him talk his way out of this. Promise me he won't get away again." Holt promised. News crews set up outside the police department that afternoon. They wanted footage of the detectives, shots of the building, any scrap of information they could turn into a soundbite. By evening, the case was leading broadcasts in Los Angeles, Orange County, and even San Diego. The public reaction was immediate and intense. Social media lit up with comments from people who had lived in Garden Grove in the 80s. Some remembered Shannon personally, a neighbor, a classmate, a co-worker. Others admitted they'd nearly forgotten about her until the headline jolted the memory back. But not all the reactions were supportive. Some questioned how it could have taken 37 years. Others speculated about whether the right man had been arrested. A few even accused the police of using the case for good PR in the middle of other controversies. Holt ignored the noise. She knew public opinion would swing back and forth until the trial, and possibly even after. What mattered now was building the case. "I reached out to several of Shannon's old friends for interviews. Many declined, saying the arrest had reopened wounds they weren't ready to talk about. But one woman, Lisa Gutierrez, agreed. She'd been Shannon's co-worker at the clothing store in 1984. When I saw his face on the news, I didn't recognize him," Lisa told me. "But I kept thinking, maybe he came into the store once. Maybe Shannon helped him pick out a shirt. That's how close this all feels. Like he could have been right in front of us, and we didn't know." Meanwhile, Holt's team began tracking Hensley's movements in the weeks before his arrest. They wanted to know if he'd heard about advances in DNA testing, or if he'd been acting nervous. Surveillance reports showed no signs of panic. He'd been living quietly, as if confident his past would stay buried. One of the most poignant moments came a few days later, when Patricia visited Shannon's grave for the first time since the arrest. A local reporter captured a photo from a respectful distance. Patricia standing at the headstone, one hand resting on it, the other holding a small bouquet of daisies. The headline the next day read, "Mother stands where justice may finally arrive." That image became the emotional anchor of the case in the media. It wasn't about the suspect anymore. It was about the family, about the cost of waiting 37 years for an answer. Behind the scenes, Holt knew the hardest part was still ahead. DNA was powerful, but it wasn't enough on its own. The prosecution needed to show the jury how Hensley could have been in Shannon's apartment without forced entry, why she would have let him in, and what motive he might have had. That meant confronting the past head-on, digging into Shannon's life, her social circle, and every possible intersection with Hensley's. Some of those answers would come from documents and records. Others would come from people who had been silent for decades. Holt braced herself for what those conversations might reveal. The past had finally stepped into the light. Now it was time to see if it would speak. Chapter 10, Trial and Verdict. The trial of Stephen Richard Hensley began on a cool Monday morning in the Orange County Superior Court. Outside, the courthouse steps were crowded with reporters, photographers, and curious onlookers. It had been 37 years since Shannon Rose Lloyd's murder, but now, Her name was on every news banner in Southern California. Detective Karen Holt arrived early, walking past the cameras without stopping. She'd been through dozens of trials, but this one carried a weight unlike any other. It wasn't just about securing a conviction. It was about proving that time hadn't eroded the truth. Inside the courtroom, the atmosphere was tense but orderly. The prosecution table was stacked with thick binders and manila folders, each one containing pieces of a puzzle that had taken decades to complete. Across the aisle, the defense team sat with Hensley, who wore a dark suit and tie. His hair was neatly combed, his face calm. If you didn't know the charges, you might think he was there for a business dispute. Judge Ellen Vargas, a seasoned jurist known for her no-nonsense demeanor, took the bench promptly at 9 a.m. The jury, 12 men and women, ranging in age from their late 20s to their 60s, filed in quietly. They knew this was no ordinary case. The prosecution opened with a timeline that stretched from May 21, 1984, to the present. Deputy District Attorney Michael Reyes spoke plainly, his voice steady. For 37 years, this case waited for science to catch up. And when it did, the evidence pointed to one man, the defendant Stephen Richard Hensley. His DNA was found under Shannon Lloyd's fingernails. That means, in her final moments, she fought him, and she left behind the truth of who killed her. He moved quickly through the history. The discovery of the body, the lack of forced entry, the preservation of the fingernail scrapings. He explained the evolution of DNA testing, showing the jury photographs of the sealed envelopes and describing the chain of custody in meticulous detail. Every step was documented, every hand that touched the evidence accounted for. When the defense took the floor, Attorney James Corcoran went on the offensive. "Ladies and gentlemen, this is not a case about murder. This is a case about contamination, about unreliable evidence from almost four decades ago. The police had no idea what they were doing with DNA in 1984, because DNA testing didn't even exist. Now they want you to believe that these old, degraded samples can tell you what happened that night. They can't, and they certainly can't prove beyond a reasonable doubt that my client is guilty." From the start, it was clear the defense would attack the science and the time gap, hoping to plant seeds of doubt about the reliability of the evidence. The prosecution's witnesses included the original crime scene technicians, now gray-haired and retired, who testified about how the evidence was collected and stored. They admitted that in 1984, they didn't anticipate DNA testing, but emphasized that they had followed the best evidence handling procedures of the time. Then came the forensic experts. Paul Rivera, the analyst who tested the fingernail scrapings in 2021, explained the process in detail. Using charts and diagrams, he showed how even small amounts of DNA could be amplified without altering its integrity. He also testified that the probability of the DNA belonging to someone other than Hensley was less than one in several trillion. The defense cross-examined aggressively. They asked about the possibility of transfer DNA, contamination in storage, and lab error. Rivera remained composed, acknowledging that contamination is always a theoretical risk, but stressing that in this case, the controls showed none. The most emotional testimony came from Patricia Lloyd. Sitting in the witness box, her voice trembled as she described getting the call in 1984 and the decades of waiting. She didn't look at Hensley while she spoke, but her words hung heavy in the courtroom. "I prayed for this day," she said. "I prayed that someone would have to answer for what they did to my daughter. I don't know why he killed her, but I know he did." When it was time for the defense to present their case, they called only a handful of witnesses. One was a forensic consultant who criticized the handling of evidence in the 80s. Another was a former co-worker of Hensley's, who testified that he had never seen him act violently. The defense did not put Hensley on the stand. Closing arguments brought the trial into sharp focus. Reyes addressed the jury directly. "This case isn't about what the police didn't know in 1984. It's about what we do know now. Shannon fought for her life, and in doing so, she told us exactly who killed her. Don't let 37 years erase her voice." Corcoran countered. "The state wants you to ignore the gaps, the uncertainties, the fact that memories fade and evidence degrades. This case is built on sand, and you cannot send a man to prison for life on sand." The jury deliberated for 2 days. Those hours stretched painfully for everyone involved. Holt stayed at her desk, working on other files, but her mind kept drifting back to the jury room. On the afternoon of the second day, the bailiff's voice came over the intercom. "We have a verdict." The courtroom filled quickly. Patricia sat in the front row, Mark beside her. Holt stood near the back, close enough to see, but far enough to stay out of the family's moment. The jury filed in. The foreperson handed the verdict form to the bailiff, who passed it to Judge Vargas. She read it silently, then looked up. "We, the jury, find the defendant, Stephen Richard Hensley, guilty of murder in the first degree." A gasp escaped from Patricia. She covered her mouth, tears streaming down her face. Hensley showed no reaction, his gaze fixed on the table in front of him. Holt exhaled slowly. 37 years of waiting, of false starts and dead ends, had led to this moment. The judge thanked the jury for their service and scheduled sentencing for the following month. As the courtroom emptied, Patricia approached Holt. She didn't say anything. She just hugged her, holding on for a long time. For the first time since 1984, the Lloyd family had an answer. And soon, they would have a measure of justice. The arrest of Stephen Richard Hensley sent a shockwave through Garden Grove. For 37 years, he had lived as an ordinary man, working jobs, paying bills, blending into the background of Southern California life. But now, the DNA beneath Shannon Rose Lloyd's fingernails had pulled him into the harsh light of a courtroom. Detective Karen Holt had spent months preparing for this moment. The evidence was airtight, but the case was anything but easy. Prosecutors knew the defense would attack every detail. The age of the samples, the chain of custody, the possibility of contamination. The trial would be a battle not only over facts, but over the idea that justice can still stand after decades. For Shannon's family, walking into the courthouse was like reopening an old wound that had never fully healed. Her mother, Patricia, had waited most of her life to see the man accused of killing her daughter held accountable. Every step through the marble halls brought back 1984. The phone call, the police cars, the endless nights of not knowing. Inside the courtroom, Hensley sat at the defense table in a dark suit, hands folded, expression unreadable. The jury, 12 strangers tasked with deciding his fate, would hear about the violent night Shannon was killed, the evidence sealed away for decades, and the science that had finally broken the silence. The trial would test everyone. The investigators who had carried the weight of the case, the forensic experts defending their methods, and a family determined not to let time dull the truth. And even when the verdict came, there would still be one more step. Sentencing day, when the court would decide how the rest of Hensley's life would be spent. This is the final act in a story that began in a quiet apartment on a May night in 1984. It's about what happens when science, persistence, and the refusal to forget finally collide with the justice system. And whether, after a lifetime of waiting, justice still feels like enough. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave a comment. The next story might change your mind. Don't miss a single turn. Chapter 11, Sentencing Day. Sentencing days are quieter than verdict days. The crowds are smaller, the tension less about uncertainty and more about finality. For families like the Lloyds, it's the last official chapter in a case that has consumed decades of their lives. On the morning of Stephen Richard Hensley's sentencing, the Orange County Superior Court was calm. The media presence was still there, but without the crush of cameras that had filled the steps during the trial. The headlines had already been written. Convicted in 1984 murder, man faces life in prison. Now it was a matter of hearing the words from the judge's mouth. Detective Karen Holt arrived early. She didn't have to be there. Her job was technically done, but she knew the Lloyds would want to see her. Patricia and her son Mark were seated in the front row, dressed in black. Patricia's hands were clasped tightly in her lap, the way they had been on verdict day. She'd told Holt the night before, "I just want to hear it said out loud. I want it on the record forever." Hensley was brought in wearing the standard orange jail jumpsuit. He looked older than he had during the trial, the weeks in custody carving new lines into his face. His hands were cuffed in front of him, his gait slow but steady. He glanced briefly toward the gallery, but didn't acknowledge the family. Judge Ellen Vargas took the bench promptly at 9 a.m. The case was called and the clerk read the charge aloud. Count 1, murder in the first degree verdict, guilty. Before sentencing, the court allowed for victim impact statements. Patricia stood first. She walked to the podium with a folded sheet of paper in her hand, but when she began speaking, she didn't look at it. "Shannon was my daughter. She was my best friend. She was taken from me in the most violent way imaginable. For 37 years, I woke up every day wondering if her killer was still walking free, wondering if I'd pass him in the grocery store or at the gas station. I prayed for this day. I prayed that someone would have to answer for what they did to her. And now you will, Mr. Hensley. Her voice didn't shake, but her eyes stayed locked on Hensley the entire time. He didn't look back. Mark spoke next. His statement was shorter, but no less direct. When you killed my sister, you took more than her life. You took every holiday, every birthday, every moment our family could have had with her. You stole decades from us. And for what? You can never give them back. But today, you will lose your freedom, the way you took hers. The prosecutor, Michael Reyes, made a brief statement, urging the court to impose the maximum sentence allowed by law. This was a senseless act of violence against a young woman in her own home. The defendant lived his life for nearly 4 decades, while the victim's family lived with a wound that never healed. The only just outcome is life in prison without the possibility of parole. When it was the defense's turn, Hensley's attorney, James Corcoran, asked the court for leniency, citing his client's age and lack of prior violent convictions. Mr. Hensley has maintained his innocence from the beginning. We ask the court to consider his advanced years and the fact that he has lived peacefully for much of his life. Judge Vargas listened without interruption, then turned to Hensley. Mr. Hensley, you have been convicted by a jury of your peers of the murder of Shannon Rose Lloyd. The evidence against you was strong, and the jury found it compelling. You took the life of a young woman in her own home, a place where she had every right to feel safe. For 37 years, you lived free while her family lived in pain. That ends today. She sentenced him to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Patricia exhaled audibly. It was the sound of something leaving her after decades. Not joy, not relief exactly, but a release. Hensley was escorted out of the courtroom without speaking. He didn't look back at the Lloyds. He didn't ask for a final word. Outside the courthouse, Patricia and Mark stood with Holt and Reyes for a brief press conference. Patricia spoke first. Justice is never late if it comes. Today we got it for Shannon. I want other families with cold cases to know. Don't stop asking. Don't stop calling. Your loved one's case matters. The cameras clicked, reporters shouted questions, but Patricia didn't take any. She had said what she came to say. Back inside, the court staff began clearing the docket for the next case. For them, it was just another day's work. But for the Lloyd family, it was the end of a 37-year fight and the start of life after justice. Holt told me later that sentencing days are bittersweet. You get the win, but you also know it doesn't bring the person back. It's closure, but not the kind that fills the hole. That night, Patricia lit a single candle on her kitchen table, beside a framed photo of Shannon. She didn't celebrate. She didn't cry. She just sat there, quiet, letting the weight of the day settle. The trial was over. The sentence was handed down. And for the first time since 1984, the case file could be stamped closed. Chapter 12. Lessons in Justice. Every cold case that finally ends in a conviction leaves behind more than just a closed file. It leaves a trail of lessons, some about the law, some about science, and some about people. In the weeks after Stephen Richard Hensley was sentenced to life in prison without parole for the murder of Shannon Rose Lloyd, I spent hours in conversation with Detective Karen Holt. She was still decompressing from the trial, still adjusting to the fact that she'd actually achieved what every cold case investigator dreams of. Taking a file that was older than her police career and turning it into a conviction. It's funny, she told me. You think the lesson is going to be about DNA. And sure, the science is huge. But the real lesson here was persistence. If Shannon's evidence had been thrown out in the 90s, if her file had been lost in one of the department moves, we'd have nothing. This case only got solved because somebody, every step of the way, kept it alive. That chain of somebody stretched back to 1984. The first officers who collected the evidence and sealed it properly, the cold case auditors in 2011 who noted it was viable for future testing, and Holt herself, who pushed it to the top of the priority list when she took over in 2021. Without any one of them, the chain would have broken. The science did matter, of course. In talking with Paul Rivera, the forensic analyst who handled the DNA testing, I learned just how fragile the process was. You're talking about 37-year-old skin cells, he explained. That's not a lot to work with. we had to use low copy number DNA methods and handle it in a sterile environment. And even then, you hold your breath until the profile comes up on the screen. Rivera said the second lab's verification was the real game changer. The defense can argue contamination all day, but when two labs get the same result independently, that's bulletproof in court. But lessons in justice aren't always about the technical wins. Some of the biggest takeaways from Shannon's case were about patience and expectation. For her family, the decades of waiting were almost as punishing as the crime itself. Patricia Lloyd had to live in a world where her daughter's killer was a free man. That shaped every holiday, every anniversary, every casual interaction with a stranger who might, for all she knew, have been the one. People think closure means you feel better, Patricia told me after the sentencing. It doesn't. Closure means you can stop asking the same question every day. That's all. Holt took something else from this case. The need for systematic cold case prioritization. If you've got evidence in good condition, it needs to be tested now. Don't wait for a better time or more funding. The longer you wait, the more you risk losing. Her department is now in the process of creating a database to track every unsolved homicide by evidence viability, not just by case age. Shannon's case is being used internally as an example of why that matters. The DA's office learned a lesson too. How to try a case with evidence that predates DNA testing entirely. Deputy District Attorney Michael Reyes told me, "We had to educate the jury on 1984 police work and 2021 forensic science in the same breath. It's not easy to explain why something wasn't tested for DNA in 1984 without making it sound like a mistake. We had to frame it as the reality of the time, and then show how the evidence survived long enough for us to get to it." Even the defense's strategy had lessons. By attacking the age of the evidence and the possibility of contamination, they were trying to chip away at the certainty that DNA usually carries in modern juries. It didn't work this time, but it underscored the need for airtight chain of custody documentation in any cold case brought to trial. There was one final lesson, though. The one that stuck with me most. It came from something Patricia said during our last interview for this story. We were sitting at her kitchen table, the same table where Holt had told her about the arrest months earlier. The candle she'd lit on sentencing night was still there, unburned since. "You know what I learned?" Patricia said. "That time isn't what kills cases. People giving up is what kills them. Time can help you if you let it. New science, new detectives, new ways of looking at the same old thing. You just have to hold on long enough for your turn to come." Shannon's turn came 37 years after her last breath. For the Lloyd family, justice was a long, uneven road that ended in a courtroom with a single word, guilty. And for every detective still working the cases that seem impossible, Shannon's case now sits as proof that impossible doesn't mean forever. Chapter 13, The Ripple Effect. When the verdict came down in the murder of Shannon Rose Lloyd, the headlines were immediate. But what happened in the months afterward was quieter, and in some ways more important. Shannon's case didn't just bring closure to one family. It shook loose a wave of change that rippled through law enforcement agencies across Southern California and beyond. The same week Stephen Richard Hensley was sentenced, I received an email from a detective in San Diego who'd been following the case closely. His message was short. "We've got a box just like yours. Time to open it." Detective Karen Holt wasn't surprised. The moment you prove a 37-year-old case can be solved, every other cold case detective looks at their shelves differently, she told me. "It's not just a theory anymore, it's a roadmap." The roadmap, as Holt described it, had three main points. Preservation matters. If evidence is stored correctly, decades-old samples can still yield results. Prioritize by viability, not age. Focus first on cases with preserved biological evidence, regardless of when the crime occurred. Push for testing now. Waiting for the right time risks losing the opportunity altogether. In the months following Hensley's conviction, Garden Grove PD submitted 8 other cold cases for DNA testing. 2 of them came back with hits in Cody's. Both are now active investigations, though the department hasn't released details. The ripple spread beyond Garden Grove. The Orange County District Attorney's Office created a dedicated cold case task force, bringing together prosecutors, forensic analysts, and detectives from multiple cities. Holt was asked to be one of the lead advisors, using Shannon's case as the blueprint for building airtight prosecutions on decades-old evidence. One of the biggest impacts came from a surprising place: budget meetings. City councils and county boards, often reluctant to spend on cold case work, now had a tangible success story to point to. Shannon's case showed that funding forensic testing wasn't just throwing money into the wind. It could deliver results that mattered to real families. But the ripple wasn't limited to law enforcement. Shannon's story began appearing in advocacy circles focused on unsolved homicides. Patricia Lloyd was invited to speak at a national conference for families of murder victims. She stood on stage in front of more than 200 people, most of them still waiting for answers, and told them not to stop calling their detectives. "Be the voice that keeps your case alive," she said. "If I could wait 37 years and still get my answer, you can too." Forensic labs took notice as well. Rivera, the analyst who worked Shannon's evidence, told me his lab used the case as part of training for new hires. "We show them the original envelopes from 1984, he said. "We talk about chain of custody, about low-copy DNA techniques, about the importance of double verification. It's a lesson in both science and patience." Of course, the ripple wasn't purely positive. Defense attorneys began preparing for a new wave of cold case prosecutions, sharpening their strategies for attacking old evidence. In workshops and seminars, they discussed contamination risks, witness memory decay, and the challenge of reconstructing crime scenes decades later. Shannon's case had proven the state could win, but it also gave the defense bar a template for how to fight back. Holt understood that reality. "Every case after this will be harder," she said. "The defense will point to any weakness, any gap in the timeline, any missing page from the file. That's why we have to be better. We have to know these cases inside out before we ever walk into court." The ripple even reached the public. True crime forums dissected Shannon's case, debating how DNA technology had evolved and whether similar breakthroughs were likely in other cold cases. On social media, hashtags like #testtheevidence began circulating, driven by families urging police to re-examine old files. One story that stuck with me came from Riverside County. A woman named Carol messaged me after reading an article I'd written on the case. Her sister had been murdered in 1989, and for years, the police told her there was nothing left to test. After seeing Shannon's case, she pushed again. This time, the department agreed to recheck the evidence. 2 months later, Carol called me, her voice shaking. "They found DNA. They're sending it to the lab now." Not every ripple ends in justice, but each one creates the possibility. And in the world of cold cases, possibility is often the most precious thing a family can have. Shannon's case also sparked an internal culture shift in Garden Grove PD. Holt started a monthly cold case review meeting, where detectives present their dormant files and brainstorm fresh strategies. The room has a rule: no case is too old to matter, and no suggestion is off the table. The lesson, Holt said, is that the value of a solved case isn't measured only in convictions. It's measured in momentum. When you show people it's possible, they start to believe again. And when they believe, they work harder. The ripple effect of Shannon's case is still moving outward. Some waves will reach other cities, other families, other courtrooms. Some will fade quietly. But the fact that they began at all, in a dusty evidence room, with an envelope sealed in 1984, is proof that justice doesn't have to be quick to be real. And maybe that's the biggest ripple of all. The reminder that time, for all its cruelty, can also be the thing that brings the truth to the surface. Chapter 14, A Mother's Resolve. When I think about the case of Shannon Rose Lloyd, one image stays with me more than any crime scene photograph, courtroom exchange, or forensic report: Patricia Lloyd sitting at her kitchen table with a spiral-bound notebook in front of her. The notebook wasn't anything special: lined pages, a bent cover, the edges softened from years of turning. But inside was 37 years of persistence: dates of phone calls to detectives, names of people she'd spoken to, newspaper clippings folded between pages. Sometimes just a single sentence scrawled in her neat, slanted handwriting: "No news this year." Patricia started it in 1984, the week after Shannon's funeral. "It was the only way I could keep track of what they told me," she said. "I didn't want to forget. And I didn't want them to forget me." For the first year, the entries came almost weekly. As the investigation slowed, the space between notes grew longer, months then years. But she never stopped. Every May 21st, the anniversary of Shannon's death, she would call the police. Even if there was nothing new, She wanted them to hear her voice, to know she was still waiting. Patricia's resolve didn't come from optimism alone. It came from a deep, steady refusal to let her daughter's name slip quietly into the past. "People think grief fades," she told me. "It doesn't. You just learn how to carry it. But if you're not careful, the world will try to bury it for you." I wasn't going to let that happen. Her persistence sometimes put her at odds with the police. In the 90s, when DNA was first making headlines, Patricia asked if Shannon's evidence could be tested. The answer was cautious but firm. "Not yet. The samples were too small, the technology not reliable enough." She accepted the explanation, but she wrote it down. Years later, when she asked again, she reminded them of that conversation. "If you write it down, they can't tell you they never said it," she said with a smile that was half pride, half defiance. When Detective Karen Holt took over the cold case unit in 2021, one of her first calls was to Patricia. Holt expected a wary reception. Families in long unsolved cases often greeted new detectives with polite skepticism. Instead, Patricia welcomed her. "If you think you can do something, I'll help you in any way I can," she told Holt. That help came in the form of memories Patricia had kept sharp through repetition. She knew exactly what Shannon had worn the last time she saw her. She remembered the names of friends and co-workers from 1984. She could list, without hesitation, the neighbors who had lived in Shannon's building that year. Many of those names had never made it into the official file. "You'd be surprised how often that happens," Holt told me later. "Families remember details that got missed the first time. Sometimes those details make all the difference." But for Patricia, the fight wasn't only about the case. It was about making sure Shannon's life was remembered beyond her death. She organized small memorials on anniversaries, gathering family and friends at the cemetery to share stories. She donated to domestic violence shelters in Shannon's name, even though Shannon's murder didn't fit that category. "It was about helping women stay safe," Patricia said. When the arrest finally came in 2021, Patricia was ready in a way few people could be after 37 years. She knew the trial would be draining. She knew the defense would try to undermine the evidence. But she also knew she'd finally get to look the man accused of killing her daughter in the eye. That moment came on the first day of the trial. Patricia sat in the front row as Hensley entered the courtroom. She didn't avert her gaze. She wanted him to know who she was and why she was there. "I didn't feel anger," she told me afterward. "I felt steady. I thought, this is the man who took my daughter, and he's not walking away this time." Throughout the proceedings, Patricia was a constant presence. She didn't miss a single day of testimony. She sat quietly, hands folded, listening as strangers described the most intimate and violent moments of her daughter's final night. She didn't flinch at the crime scene photos, though others in the courtroom looked away. After the verdict, when Hensley was found guilty, Patricia allowed herself a long, quiet exhale. She didn't celebrate in the courtroom. She saved that for home, where she lit a candle by Shannon's photo and let it burn into the night. At sentencing, Patricia delivered her impact statement without notes. Her voice was calm but unshakable. "For 37 years, I wondered if you'd ever be caught. I wondered if you'd ever have to answer for what you did. Now you will." She didn't cry. She didn't raise her voice. She spoke as someone who had been preparing for this moment for more than half her life. When I asked her later how she had kept going, she pointed to the same spiral notebook. "This," she said. "I wrote it all down. Every no. Every maybe. Every scrap of hope. You do that long enough, you build something that can't be erased." Patricia still keeps the notebook, though the last entry is dated the day of the verdict. She hasn't decided if she'll keep adding to it. "I guess that depends on whether I feel like the fight is really over." Because for Patricia, justice wasn't just about the arrest, or the trial, or the sentence. It was about making sure Shannon's name would never be just another unsolved file in a dusty evidence room. And in that, she succeeded. Chapter 15, The Final Word. Every case has an ending, but not every ending feels like it closes the story. Shannon Rose Lloyd's case is one of those rare few where the ending, though far from perfect, carries a sense of completion. When I sat down to write this final chapter, I went back over my notes from the past 2 years. Interviews, trial transcripts, forensic reports, and late-night conversations with Detective Karen Holt. I wanted to understand what this journey meant to each person who lived it. For Holt, the case was both a professional triumph and a personal awakening. It reminded me why I became a detective, she told me. Not for the easy cases, but for the ones that everyone else has given up on. It's easy to think of a 37-year-old murder as unsolvable. But every time you say unsolvable, you're making a choice to stop looking. This case taught me never to stop looking. For forensic analyst Paul Rivera, the case was a testament to the resilience of evidence. We handle thousands of samples in a career, he said. Most don't mean anything to us personally. They're just numbers on a form. But this one, every time I saw Lloyd Shannon R. on that envelope, I thought about how long her family had been waiting. That kind of responsibility changes how you work. Deputy District Attorney Michael Reyes reflected on the challenge of bridging the past and present in the courtroom. We had to put the jury in two worlds at once. 1984, when DNA didn't exist as a tool, and 2021, when it's one of the strongest forms of evidence we have. The defense wanted to make those worlds incompatible. Our job was to show they were part of the same story, and that the story ended with the defendant in that chair. And then there was Patricia Lloyd. When I visited her one last time, she was in her garden, tending to the small patch of flowers she'd kept for decades. Shannon's favorite daisies bloomed near the walkway. Patricia's spiral notebook, the one that documented her decades of calls, questions, and refusals to let the case fade, sat on the porch table. She had added one more line since I last saw it. Justice served. It doesn't bring her back, Patricia said softly. But it means I can sleep at night without wondering if anyone will ever pay for what happened. It means I can put down the phone and stop asking. And it means Shannon's name will always be tied to the fact that we didn't give up. The ripple effects of Shannon's case are still unfolding. Other departments are testing old evidence because of it. Other families are finding their voices again. And in Garden Grove, the cold case unit now reviews every dormant homicide annually, a policy that didn't exist before Holt pushed for it. But perhaps the most important legacy is less tangible. It's the reminder that time doesn't erase truth. It only buries it. The truth is still there, waiting for the right combination of persistence, science, and people willing to keep the light on. As I close my notebook on this case, I'm left with one final image. It's not the crime scene or the courtroom, or even the verdict. It's Patricia in that garden, her hands in the soil, tending to something that will outlast her. She knows the flowers will need care again next season, but for now they're blooming. And that's enough.